Welcome to The West Steps, a podcast from the Colorado Children's Campaign that explores issues that impact Colorado kids and families. I'm your host, Beza Tedes.
Welcome to The West Steps, another episode from Stuck at Home, I guess. This week, we have one of my coworkers, Stephanie, who's been on the podcast before. And just before we jump in, for those who don't know what you do at the Children's Campaign, can you give us a little bit of what you do and maybe something that has been keeping you sane for the past couple of weeks?
Sure. Thanks, Beza, for having me on again. And my name is Stephanie Perez Carrillo, and I'm one of the policy analysts here at the Children's Campaign. I was hired initially to work on K through 12 and then some healthy eating, active living initiatives, but that has since kind of transformed to be responsive to what, you know, our communities need and to ensure that we're, you know, doing what's best for kids. So sometimes that just looks differently. It looks like housing, it looks like food security. And so it kind of shifts to be responsive, especially at this time. And what I'm doing to stay sane, I think, are a couple of things. First thing is I bought a 1,000-piece puzzle. It's taken a lot of time, and it's probably one of the hardest puzzles I've ever done, but you just kind of suspend time and stress while working on it. And then my sister gave me access to her Peloton account, and I've been trying some workout classes. So those two things have been kind of keeping me sane.
That's good to hear. Okay. So bread making and bread eating has not infiltrated your household just yet?
No, I don't know if you want me making bread right now. It wouldn't turn out well. I've never been a baker, and COVID doesn't change that.
So I think today we'll talk a little bit about food security and what the federal and the state government are doing to ensure kids and families have adequate food to eat during this pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I think the most logical place to start is school has been closed for several weeks now, and mm-hmm. announced that they are closed for the rest of the summer. And I was wondering, so now that kids are not at school, where a significant portion of Colorado kids get their only meal at school, what is happening to ensure kids are eating?
Yeah, it's a great question. And if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, I still would have been kind of scrambling, as I think a lot of folks are. Even folks at the district level, I think, have been working really frantically to ask the Department of Education, to ask the Department of Human Services, the Department of Public Health and Environment to better understand how these meal services are all working. And what's interesting about Colorado is that each of those agencies works with nutrition programs at different capacities. And mm-hmm. so in short, it was really encouraging to see the Department of Education and all the other agencies I just mentioned work so quickly with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to get waivers approved for things that the school districts were already preparing for. Like every year we have the summer food service program at, you know, about 200 or so approved sites around the state. And, you know, the department acted quickly and followed suit with a lot of other states in getting waivers approved to kind of get that summer food service program started a little bit sooner. Mm-hmm. And along with that came a wave of 10 or so waivers that resulted in more than 800 meal sites being available for parents and families and for kiddos. So the waivers are pretty extensive, but then, you know, are meant to address the current need that we have right now, recognizing that some parents have lost their jobs and some folks just don't have access to things like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or others at this time, just because they're still trying to figure out, okay, my kid's not in school and is not receiving these at least two guaranteed meals. How do I ensure that I'm understanding how this has changed given the social distancing orders and then the stay-at-home orders, which, you know, allow for parents and, you know, guardians to stop by school sites and other sites that have been open to pick up these foods.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand correctly, schools are providing food programs they would have provided in the summer just a little bit earlier to accommodate for the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And kids and families are going to those food sites to pick up the food. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And what's happened is that, you know, we had a smaller amount of school sites than we did last summer. So if you look at last summer, we had around 200 sites around the state that were providing summer meals. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few requirements, you know, eligibility requirements that sites have to meet in order to become an operator during the summer. And so what happened was these waivers kind of expanded what an allowable site was, and took away some of those, or removed some of those requirements temporarily as part of the waivers that were applied for. So what we see is that it went from 200 sites last summer to over 800 sites operating at the current moment. I think the total number is 826 different sites in Colorado today that are providing meals for children and families.
And how are parents identifying these food sites and accessing them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are two key organizations and agencies that have been working on this. One, the Department of Education, the Colorado Department of Education, has posted on their website a lot of COVID resources for schools. And one of those is a map where you can essentially type in your zip code and find where the site that's providing food is closest to you, what the hours are. And Hunger Free is another organization that has posted a very similar resource so that you know which school sites, if it's a school site or if it's an alternative site in your community, is offering the food service. And then it also shares kind of the hours in which they're operating, because a lot of these schools are operating, you know, with a limited capacity, and then are also needing protective equipment and gear to serve, you know, these kids and these families.
Yeah, I think that leads to my next question, which is that these 800 or so food sites, what are some of the challenges that they are facing in order to provide adequate food for kids and families?
Yeah. You know, I think the first one that came up was transportation, right? In a lot of rural communities, or even when we think of southwest corner of Colorado, there are only a few sites that were approved and that received the waiver to operate. And so how are we thinking about folks that aren't able to utilize transportation to get to these sites? I think the other piece was that once you got to your respective site 2 weeks ago, you were only allowed to consume one meal, or you were only allowed to pick up, let's say, the meal for the day. And so I think school districts and those sites and those school food service providers are trying to think of more creative ways where they can get more meals at any given point to families than just one for the day. So rather than having to return to the site every single day, how they can provide maybe a week's worth or a weekend worth of food for those respective kids. And I think those are just some of the challenges. And then some of the more obvious ones are, you know, how we're ensuring that we're abiding by some of the social distancing measures while like having parents come by the sites and pick up that food while protecting and keeping our school nutrition and the folks that are working at those sites safe. So I think there's still a lot of requests from the federal government around providing protective gear and equipment to those people that are really on the front lines and that are providing food to family and kiddos. But I, you know, I'd be interested to hear more from them about what challenges they've met and how they're kind of overcoming that. Because in my mind, we're just setting up, you know, the structure really quickly so that folks in our state know exactly where to get food and have access to that. But in terms of operating procedures and what the challenges are, I imagine they vary based on whether you're a rural district or in an urban setting. I think it would vary based on that.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of things to juggle from a safety perspective, from increasing demand and resources, especially as more and more families are losing their jobs. I think, you know, we just heard the federal government not so long ago, even though it feels like about 10 years ago now, passed the CARES Act, which had some funding for food security in there. Can you tell us what was in that bill and how Colorado is making use of those resources?
Yeah, I think what's been the clearest as of March 20th, which was when we received kind of this briefing from the Joint Budget Committee, there were two kind of pieces that were a little bit clear for us. One was specifically for, actually both were through the Department of Human Services, but the one that makes sense to focus on right now is for the Supplemental Nutrition Service Program, and then just in general, the Senior Nutrition Program. So those are the two that I think kind of spell out the amount of funding that we're getting as it relates to food. So when we look at the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's kind of an additional program that is supporting communities and children and families around the state that's providing food. And so they're receiving $400 million, or there was an allocation of $400 million to assist local food banks to meet the increased demand for low-income Americans during this emergency. And then $300 million of that is for the purchase of nutritious food, and then $100 million is to support the storage and distribution of the food. And that's just on a broader scale. And so what that looks like and how that translates to the Department of Education and the child nutrition programs that are administered that way is still being determined, and I'm still learning. But that's just one of the things that we know from the CARES Act, the amount of funding that will be devoted to providing food and to providing the safe storage of that food for folks in the state.
And I think this is a good place to start talking a little bit about with SNAP and with other food resources, food programs. There's already a lot of discussion about the quality of that food and the safe storage of that food. Mm-hmm. Also, how it's not able to meet the needs of communities. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that conversation is like? I just don't think we should lose sight of that conversation.
Yeah, I think it's hard to kind of understand there for two reasons. One, of the $400 million that I just alluded to, we don't know how much of that Colorado is actually getting. The second piece is here in Colorado, prior to all of this, as it relates to SNAP, we had one of the highest eligible but not enrolled rates, which meant that we had a lot of people that were eligible for these services, but were not enrolled for any number of reasons. One, the application can be pretty extensive and exhaustive and has to be done in person. Some people that are eligible for these services don't necessarily know that they are. And so I think, partners like Hunger Free and other state agencies have been trying to think of creative ways to get people who are enrolled and, eligible enrolled. And now even more so as we see that folks are getting laid off or are losing their jobs, we're expecting to see an increase in the number of folks that take up these SNAP benefits. And so I think the department is trying to think really creatively about, how do we ensure that we remove the barriers for folks to enroll in these programs so that we're allowing them to meet their basic needs, or we're supporting them in meeting their basic needs. And I think that that's one of the challenges, right? Especially for folks who don't have broadband access, which I think we heard is still 25,000 students in the state of Colorado. What does that mean for if you're going to try to apply online to receive some of these benefits? It means that you're not able to because you don't have broadband access. So thinking creatively about how we reach those students and folks in those communities that don't have broadband access, to fill out applications online or even to renew some of their benefits. So I think, there are a lot of good partners that are coming together to think about what creative solutions in this realm are, recognizing that there's several public benefit programs that folks are eligible for. It's just a matter of helping them understand that they're eligible and then aligning them with the application and then getting them set up. But I think these things take time in terms of going through the application, you have to provide proof of so many different documentation. And so from the time that you kind of fill out that application to the time you see the benefits, it can take anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks. And so, if you think about the time that we've already been in stay-at-home orders or the time that, you know, we were first sent home from our jobs, it's already been a month. And mm-hmm. so some folks will not see those benefits for 4 to 6 weeks, even after having gone through the application process.
Yeah. So I think just to see if I understood what you were saying, I think that the proof of burden in creating the eligibility for this application is very burdensome. So people have to go through a lot to show that they are eligible for these services. And mm-hmm. when we talk about these services, we're not talking about some expansive food pantries, right? Like we're talking about some of the basic food assistance programs here.
Right.
And once people do prove that they are eligible, the application process is a lot and it takes a long time, even once you've been approved for these programs and to receive these programs. And mm-hmm. can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, I think sometimes it's kind of lost on us what we mean by these food assistance programs. What is a very kind of obvious or more like a very common food package here? What does that resource look like? Because I think, you know, for some of us we might not have never seen what it feels like to go to a school to receive that one meal a day, or go have to rely on you know, our local food pantry to be able to feed our families. So can you give us an idea of what that looks like?
Yeah, I think the one thing that comes to mind is when I visited you know, a food bank when I was in Naderita, mm-hmm. and that's in the southwestern part of the state. And when, you know, I was able to see what the food bank was stocked with, it was mostly some dry goods and non-perishables. So, you know, cereals, some bread, some canned goods, ramen, like things that don't go bad. And mm-hmm. I think they're largely at the mercy of, you know, the larger food bank folks like Food Bank of the Rockies, mm-hmm. which is a good partner in providing food to see what they're going to get. And, you know, I think what's interesting at this time is that you have farmers who are throwing away mass quantities of food because the retail industry is not like meeting that demand, or there really isn't as much demand. And yet, you know, the food banks don't have a lot of storage capacity when it comes to refrigeration, when it comes to actually absorbing a lot of these things that would be helpful to infusing community. There's just a really interesting gap between how much storage these food banks actually have and then the need. And then also the amount of waste that's happening, you know, from the farmers who are massively producing things like grains, things like corn, you know, commodities that I think are important. And so there's just a misalignment that's really bizarre. And so I think some food banks are like, actually, we need like a refrigerator to store some of these perishables, and we need more storage space. And I think, you know, in that case, there's that misalignment that we wouldn't necessarily understand. Like, I think the best way to equate it is like, we've been going to grocery stores to try to buy toilet paper and some other pieces, and every time we go, like, the demand is just not meeting the supply. And so it's very similar in terms of what the food bank situation is looking like, where, you know, food banks are only allotted a certain amount of food because that's what they can hold and the capacity that they can hold. Mm-hmm. But then you have this food that's kind of being thrown away and wasted. And so it's just like a very bizarre thing to contextualize, because you're like, what do you mean there's like, we don't have this, or what do you mean we can't store some of this food? It just feels like a logical thing to be able to do. Yet these are some of the constraints that they're operating within.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think this highlight, at least for me, is how the structures and infrastructures that we have put in place to secure food security, I think, is just misaligned, as you said. You know, like, I think even if people wanted to donate a lot of food, a lot of perishable foods, that our food banks are not equipped to store those foods adequately and be able to distribute them in a way that meets people's needs as they need them, not wait 4 to 6 weeks. And I think, you know, we will continue to talk about how, you know, after, hopefully sometime soon, when we get back to rethinking about how we design these systems again, I think one of the ways that we really have to think about is that how we fund our local food banks to be able to not just store food, but also store and distribute that food adequately to families whenever they need them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other piece that's been illuminated for me too, is you have limited amount of staff that work at the food bank, right? And so mm-hmm. they're seeing increases in the number of people that are visiting and the number of packages they're giving out and the number and the amount of food that they're giving out. So let's say that they received food for a week to give out to their community. They're seeing their supply go within a day or within 2 days because the demand is just so high. And so there could be people that go through the food bank that just miss that 2 day window. And so that's kind of the tension that I think a lot of food banks are wrestling with. And so just to be clear, you know, SNAP is, you know, a supplemental program where you receive a set amount of funds per month and you can use that to buy certain things at a grocery store. And so the food banks are really a complement to programs like SNAP that help kind of provide this safety net of public benefits to ensure that families have access to meet some of their basic needs. And so, you know, what the Department of Education is doing and the Department of Human Services in providing and administering these programs through the Child Nutrition Program Services and then SNAP and others is in partnership or is important to complement the work that food banks are doing, right? Because food banks largely rely on larger suppliers who have a surplus and who are giving that surplus away. And it's a shame that you know, a bill that our friends over at Hunger Free Colorado were working on was to incentivize local farmers donating some foods to food banks. And unfortunately, since session has been in pause, that's not something that we can currently advocate for. But how cool would it be that these farmers who are throwing away mass quantities of food would be able to donate it to food banks and then receive some type of stipend or some type of tax credit? And how cool would that be to have right now, and for food banks to kind of have the storage that they need to get that from farmers, and so it's not going to waste, it's being used by communities that need it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, some of this conversation also leads us to think about those of us who might not be directly impacted by food insecurity, and all of us are a lot more closer to that than we think, you know. And so what can people do? What are some of the things that people can do to ensure that their neighbors are not going hungry and their and family and friends are not going hungry right now?
Yeah, I think there's one really practical thing that, you know, organizations are doing, and that's they're kind of asking or showing where the need is and then putting it out to the next works and saying like, hey, we need folks to help us serve meals during this time. I know FaithBridge here in Denver asked folks to serve at different high schools to help get meals out to families. And so that's one thing that you could look into: which organizations can you volunteer for and which ones actually need help, recognizing that, you know, it's that volunteering, right? Like they might be short on staff. They might need people to just lend a hand to serve meals and to provide some of the meals that families pick up. So that's one piece. I think a second piece is just being a good neighbor, right? Like there have been multiple times in the last 3 weeks where my own neighbor has come over and has asked me, and he's like, she's like, do you have some sugar, or do you by any chance have, you know, some extra eggs? And so I think in a very practical manner of like being a good neighbor, and like if our neighbors ask us for something that we have, sharing it. You know, I know there's been multiple times where you've baked like delicious breads and have shared them with me. Like if you're a person who has that skill and who is a baker and who can cook, just think about ways that you can be encouraging your neighbors by maybe baking for them. A friend of mine is an excellent baker, and she ran out of flour, and I had it, and I was like, just take my flour because I'm not going to use it. And so I think if we can practice being good neighbors and kind of sharing, like this is a moment where we can show that to our neighbors.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, I think it might not seem pretty obvious to a lot of us, is I think, you know, we all have the luxury of going to the grocery store and buying the food that we need. But I think, you know, there are some families, especially families on things like SNAP, they can't buy all the things that are available at the supermarket. There are some things that there are only a few things that they're allowed to buy. So I think that when you go shopping for yourself and for your family, look out and see if those foods are, you know, are marked for things like WIC or SNAP, and leave those to those who have very limited options. And, you know, there are over 200, types of cereal that we can buy, but families on food programs like WIC and SNAP can only buy a very limited number of food items. So leave those, even if they are, you know, relatively the cheapest one or things like that, so that they have something to buy at the grocery store. And also, if you have, you know, extra pantry items, like, you can donate them to your food, your local food banks. And I think, you know, as you said, just being kind neighbors, and, you know, none of us can survive without food. So being able to share that, I think, is one way to make sure that we all looking out for each other.
Yeah. And I think something that I saw was really cool is, like, on a sunny day when it was beautiful, I was walking outside, and here in Denver, we have a lot of the little public libraries where, or free little libraries that people have on their yards. One of my neighbor turned it into a free little pantry. And so they removed all their books and instead put, free items in there, like canned goods, cereal, bread, and other pieces and other things. And so what's been interesting to see is how that little free library being utilized as a free little pantry, and how it's actually being used. Like, those things haven't stayed in that space for more than a couple of days, and people are contributing as well as removing as they need it. So I think there are a lot of things that you could be doing in your respective community to be a good neighbor. And even if you come across something that looks like a free little library, asking the person if they want to turn it into a free little pantry.
Yeah. And I think the last thing I'll add is, as Stephanie just talked about, we have a lot of people in Colorado who are eligible but not enrolled for a lot of food security programs. So, and if you think you can help by enrolling your neighbor, or helping with the application process, or, you know, sharing your broadband or anything like that to encourage people to take up these services so that they can feed their families, is one way you can also help. You might not be able to, you know, bake a bread for but I think, you know, you can help, you know, explain the process if you're able, or share the resources from the Colorado Education Department website, a way to find these, emergency sites and things like that with your neighbors, friends, and families and relatives, or even sharing them on your own social media. I think that's a great way to reach people in your network.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for making the time for us, Stephanie, and explaining, an issue that touches all of us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. And I know we still have lots to learn in this realm because it's changing every single day. So thanks for the grace in letting me explain what I know.
Thank you so much.
I have one of my colleagues to help me with some ads, previous guests of the West Steps. Steph.
That's me.
Who's our sponsor this week?
Support for this episode is provided by Effect, a Denver-based digital agency that helps campaigns win elections. Effect supports outstanding candidates and initiatives that are focused on winning their election in order to positively transform communities. Learn more at EFFCT.org.
You want to say that last part again? Where can people go?
EFFCT.org.
That's effect.org. Thank you, Steph.
Thank you.
The West Steps is a production of the Colorado Children's Campaign. To support our work, please visit coloradokids.org. And I'll see you next week.